Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Meskwaki people have done a great deal to preserve their history, protect their culture, and reclaim their heritage. The Meskwaki Agriculture and Food Sovereignty Initiative is one of the latest projects designed to reconnect with and preserve Meskwaki historical culture and empower modern Meskwaki people. Shelley Buffalo, local foods coordinator of the initiative, and Grant Shadden, farm production manager at Red Earth Gardens on the Meskwaki settlement, are both here to tell us about the work they've been doing. Shelley, welcome.
Hey, nice to see you again, Charity.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming back to the show. And Grant, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me, Charity.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And Shelley, let's go back in time a little bit and talk about the origins of this initiative. What was the idea that started this all?
Well, I have the origins right here on the table, which is the basically the 2013-15 Food Sovereignty Strategic Plan. But the work on this strategic plan was started in 2011. And it was I wasn't in on this. Mm-hmm. I was actually currently living here in this community at that time. I was following all the developments through our newsletters, the tribal newsletters that come out each month. But this initiative, it was developed through a lot of basically asking the community, you know, what they wanted out of this. It really was community driven. So there were surveys put out. There was also VISTA workers involved, including some people who were not from the community, but including community members that were able to inform the strategic plan.
All right. So as the ball got rolling, people started to get excited about it. Before we sort of jump into that, this phrase, food sovereignty, is a phrase that a lot of people may not be familiar with. And I would love for each of you to tell me what it means to you. But Shelley, start.
Okay. Well, I'm going to... there's like this official food sovereignty kind of statement, since I can't remember that verbatim, I'm going to have to just go from what I feel from my heart.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, the right of people it's not even from a consumer point. It's you know, that growing of our traditional foods, the rights of people to be able to, you know, have a say over the type of nutrition that they're getting. It's just, well, and culturally for the Meskwaki, our foods are just tied in to every aspect of our culture. Like we can't really practice our religious ceremonies without them. You know, they're fully integrated and they always have been. And those relationships with the land. And of course, with not just with colonization, but especially I'd say within the last 60 years, the Meskwaki diet has, it has changed dramatically. I know you have Jonathan Buffalo mm-hmm. on quite a few times, and he talks about within his lifetime, and he's Jonathan, I'm not going to say your age, but within his
he's
lifetime.
He's been around a while.
Yes, he's
right.
been around. He grew up eating primarily our traditional foods that were grown on Meskwaki land. And then he has seen that transition of them going, you know, that diet then transitioning more to the grocery store bought. And of course, like now, you know, we have tons of convenience foods and they're cheap. And so since we're still, even with the casino, you know, we're still, our social economic demographic there at the settlement is still, you know, we still have a lot of people that are below or at or just above poverty level. And so those cheap foods really are kind of a necessity.
Right. So it's something, of course, we've seen happen really to everyone in the United States how cheap convenience foods have transformed the American diet. But on the Meskwaki settlement and with other tribal nations, it's compounded because your foods are an important part of your heritage and your culture mm-hmm. as well.
It's also compounded because we're genetically, you know, we are not accustomed to, for instance, you know, wheat products, dairy. I mean, there's a huge list of foods that are really common that we are just not, you know, we just don't process well. You know, it contributes to the high rates of diabetes, for example. That's one of the major diseases of Indian country. And that's like totally diet. I shouldn't say it's not completely diet related.
But there's definitely a relationship.
It's also, you know, that is one of the fallouts of trauma, historical trauma. Mm-hmm. Or you can call that inherited trauma. You know, that's something that's also written on the genes. But there's beautiful things that we're tapping into that's also written on the genes, you know. And this is the ancestral knowledge of the land as well as the ancestral knowledge of these plants and these relationships with these seeds.
Grant, I'd love for you to add your thoughts about what food sovereignty means to you.
Right. So I'm not Meskwaki, but I'm honored to be able to serve the community in the capacity as farm production manager of Red Earth Garden. So I come from a different context mm-hmm. and learning what the goals of the tribe were. And Red Earth Gardens is the production farm on the settlement. And so we look to produce large amounts of nutrient-dense organic produce and make it accessible to the community. Like Shelley was saying, you know, that this standard American diet that's, you know, been overlaid on Indian country that's caused these kind of compounded health issues. We're trying to help break some of that cycle by making this food available to the community. But we also do things with workforce development training. So training people in the Meskwaki community to grow their own food, to empower them to reconnect with the land and learn sustainable agriculture growing techniques that are resilient and adapt to these changing weather patterns that we're experiencing. So it's a little bit different of a context of what the farm is doing versus the agriculture and food sovereignty program, but we're two branches from the same tree.
I was just going to say there seem to be two important, and maybe more, but two really important elements of what you're growing, because connecting with these historical foods, growing seeds that may have been saved and passed down through generations is one part of it. But the other part is really what we see with the local foods movement all across the state of Iowa, all across the country, right, Shelley?
Oh, yeah.
Am I reading that right?
Yeah. Absolutely. So at Red Earth Gardens, it's I'm not going to speak for Red Earth Gardens, actually. I started out there. That was my first year when I transitioned back to living at Meskwaki and working for the tribe. So I'm like, I still got to like, no, that's Grant. He can speak to that. But for food sovereignty, of course, it's like you said, we're, you know, our primary crops that we're growing is the ancestral crops. And really, I love that both of these branches are working to get people back into growing their own food. So we focus on, you know, those traditional, and then Red Earth Gardens focus on, you know, just more general healthy vegetables. And I have to say, I've got to give myself props, is that when I was farm stand coordinator, I really, really advocated for making sure that the vegetables the farm, Red Earth Gardens, was growing was accessible. And that's that price point. Because I know that my Meskwaki community, that there's majority of people cannot afford to pay like what you would pay at the farmers market here in Iowa City. There's no way. And so now the structure, and then Grant, you can talk about that. I'm going to hand it over to you.
All right. Tell us a little bit more about what Red Earth Gardens is doing now, Grant.
Yeah. So like Shelley was saying, we've we've worked to reduce the barriers of access to this really good, fresh, local organic produce. So we offer a 50% off discount to all members of the Meskwaki settlement. But then we also, with our workforce development training component and making our farm financially sustainable in terms of operating costs, we're selling off the settlement as well. And we're charging, you know, reasonable, like fair market value for our organic produce. And we actually just opened an online store at our website, www.redearthgardens.com, where people can place orders online. And then we have local pickup options right now servicing Marshalltown, but we do actually want to start servicing the Iowa City area as well. So that's kind of how we're focusing in locally, but then also wanting to branch out some and offer our produce off the settlement too.
All right. So this is part of an economic development project too. You are creating a sustainable business that is not just providing produce to people who live on the Meskwaki settlement, but you're selling produce to others, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's correct.
Shelley, I want to talk about some of those historic foods, some of the cultural heritage that's been passed down through what you're growing. We're going to have to go to a break here in about a minute, but tell me about one of the things that you're growing that you feel has a connection to the past of the Meskwaki people.
Well, our primary ancestral foods are corn, beans, and squash. And those nutritionally, especially, you know, we're not talking about like sweet corn that you grow in your home garden or anything like that. You know, this is our what's called Tama Flint corn. And so this is, you know, this is what, you know, Iowa State University has, you know, our seeds, as well as a seed bank down in, I don't know if it's Kansas or whatever. So this is a seed, you know, that's been given this name by the general public or seed researchers, but, you know, because it's so important. All it's right. So vital. It's unique.
And we will talk more about it in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. With me, Shelley Buffalo, local foods coordinator of the Meskwaki Agriculture and Food Sovereignty Initiative. And Grant Shadden is here, farm production manager of Red Earth Gardens. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the Meskwaki Agriculture and Food Sovereignty Initiative. It's one of the latest projects on the Meskwaki settlement to reconnect with and preserve Meskwaki historical culture and also empower modern Meskwaki people and create a business that's sustainable through time with Red Earth Gardens, which is on the Meskwaki settlement land and will be selling to people outside the settlement as well. With me, Grant Shadden. He is farm production manager at Red Earth Gardens. And Shelley Buffalo, local foods coordinator of the Meskwaki Agriculture and Food Sovereignty Initiative. And Shelley, just before the break, we were talking about Tama Flint corn, which is something that the Meskwaki people have had a connection with for a long time. And was this corn always grown on the settlement? Has it been grown continuously through time?
It has been. That's one of the beautiful things about the Meskwaki settlement is that, and I know there, you know, there we're talking about the decline and food sovereignty is a response to that. The fact that, you know, there's a decline in growing of the traditional foods, but at the same time, there are so many families that have, you know, just year after year have maintained their gardens and kept growing that. And so, you know, this is a relationship, you know, that goes back thousands of years with this seed. And what's beautiful about it is because, you know, it's we have this relationship with this plant. It has evolved with us. We have evolved with it. So nutritionally, you know, this is like nutritionally, it's really specific to us as a people. you know, and we don't see seeds as a, just a seed or just a plant. You know, these are relatives. And another beautiful thing about that continual planting and growing out and then seed saving of the Meskwakis with their Tama Flint is that each year that seed is evolving. So, you know, we have a lot of faith that the fact that these seeds will keep growing, even though we have, you know, Grant and I, last year was the first year we worked together at the farm. And, you know, day in, day out, it was just like, my gosh, the weather's changing.
Right.
And it's challenging. You know, we've had major wind events that have ripped the plastic off of their greenhouses out there and almost sent Grant into space. You know, I mean, it's serious stuff.
Right. Well, and Grant, I mean, this year has been so wet and so difficult for farmers everywhere. I mean, we've had extreme weather conditions and some really almost unprecedented weather events this year. How is the farm faring through all of that?
Right. I mean, we certainly have had our struggles like every other farmer in the Midwest, but we have been more fortunate than others for sure. So, you know, we're realistically 4 to 5 weeks behind schedule, you know, like most other farmers, but we've been playing catch up. I've been really proud of how hard the crew and our workforce development participants have worked to get us caught up. And we've also been transitioning to no-till in our vegetable production to just make our soils more resilient and to help increase the resiliency of our plants as well. So we're working to take care of the land in a better way so that we can have better results too. And also utilizing the tribe's funds with the development of the farm to put in more greenhouses, high tunnels, and upgrading them so that we have a little more controlled growing environment, because I hate to say it, but the last couple springs, you know, field growing is almost a luxury, it seems like, yeah, in the spring. So,
well, and your farm is 40 acres, which, of course, is small by row crop standards, but that's large by growing horticultural crop standards. Tell me a little bit about what you grow and how you use that land.
Right. So we've shrunk down the footprint of the vegetable production, which had been in about 5 acres of vegetables, and we're down to 1.5, but we're doing it management intensive and actually having really good yield results through the no-till kind of biologically advanced growing methods that we're putting out on the farm now. We've also been planting things like blackberries and raspberries and strawberries, some fruit trees for perennial crops. And then next week our chicks should be coming in. We're going to do rotationally moved pastured egg-laying chickens to help heal the land in some ways, but also to have a very good organic, sustainably grown protein source for the community as well.
And you're making your own fertilizer. Or you
yes,
will be.
Yeah, we do a lot with composting and you know, soil building practices and all that.
Sounds like an incredibly diverse farm. And of course, the farm is not the only part of the Food Sovereignty Initiative. It actually began with the Elder Garden, which was put in 2013. Shelley, tell me a little bit about that garden.
Yeah, that was, you know, I believe that one started as the first community garden. And then it especially once Red Earth Garden was established, then it became Elder Garden, the Elder Garden, which is everything grown there is then held for the senior services, which is very close to our tribal center. And that's a great relationship there, because we have like two community chefs that work at the senior center, and they make all the traditional dishes. Of course, their daily meals there aren't traditional dishes, you know, where they have lunch, free lunch provided for seniors. But sometimes it is, you know, it's kind of a mix. But so we have like these great cooks with a lot of knowledge. And so, and then also we have our elders there. And so it's wonderful access, you know, because we're, you know, we're all learners. And even though I kind of feel old, I have to remind myself I'm still pretty young, especially when it comes to my culture. I'm a language learner. So I'm kind of like a toddler, maybe a little bit more advanced than that.
Because you didn't learn the language when you were growing up?
No, I didn't. I only learned baby words, really, because that's what was spoken to me. And then, you know, there wasn't expansion after that. And a lot of it, you know, this just goes back to historical trauma. This goes back to boarding school of, you know, my parents and grandparents.
And really a concerted effort to stamp out Native cultures.
Yeah. I mean, like... just matter of fact, it's my dad felt that his kids, it was better for his kids to master English and to not have that stigma of, especially, you know, there's a lot of kids that if their first language was Meskwaki, and when they went to school, they were actually put in remedial classes. They were treated like they had learning disorders, you know. And it wasn't understood. It's just like that, no, English is a second language. It's going to take some time to catch up.
Right, right. So that separating you and your siblings from the language was an investment in a successful future from your dad's perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. We are going to welcome somebody else into the conversation here, but Shelley and Grant, stay with us. Richard Elmhill is also here with us. He's a program officer for First Nation Development Institute, focusing on Native agriculture and food systems. Hello, Richard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And you are a member of the Oneida Nation in Wisconsin, and I know that you've worked with many tribal organizations, many tribal nations with their food sovereignty initiatives. But I wonder if you can tell us just a little bit about your personal connection to this movement before we talk about some of them more generally.
Right. So I grew up on the Oneida Reservation, and also in Washington State. So my grandmother worked in our cannery. My mom spent some time at Janhaqua working on their like herbal and the first rendition of the market where we would sell like herbal products out. And so I recently moved back there maybe three years ago and started working on similar projects. And it was kind of full circle for me to, you know, be where I was standing when I was younger, but now also being in the planning stages of doing that same kind of work.
I think a lot of people understand, having learned about the history of our nation, understand how colonization, settlement really damaged tribal cultures in so many ways. But I think a part of that story that not a lot of people necessarily know is how radically transformed the diet of these tribal cultures became, even before modernization, even before all of those convenience foods, but because as people were forced onto reservations, they were also given food aid, and the diet changed because of the ingredients that they had available. So can you put that in perspective for us a little bit, Richard, just of how difficult it is for some tribal nations to even connect to their historical food?
Right. So right now there are 573 federally recognized Native American tribes. Over 200 of them are in Alaska. And then there's a lot of unrecognized tribes. And so when you look at that number, you also need to say that there's, you know, that many food systems that are out there that are at various levels in terms of the health of that food system. And so when you go region by region, you have all these different needs and various levels of knowledge that exist. So a lot of the work we do is trying to reclaim some of those traditional practices, as well as like integrate the way farming is done today. So we see that all as included in a food system. And really our goal at First Nations is to support the development of healthy Indigenous food systems.
Is there some detective work that has to go into helping support Indigenous food systems, given that many of these groups didn't even have an opportunity to really record their recipes, their heritage, the history of the tribe? Is that a difficult process for a lot of groups?
Absolutely. But it's also kind of a inspiring process, especially for our younger generation. So there's always this passing of knowledge, and especially the oral traditions where, you know, you're not writing down all these recipes. You're not writing down what to do. You're kind of learning in this hands-on way. So even the passing of knowledge in that way, when it's done and done in groups and in large groups, that's the best way, one of the best ways to receive information. The other thing is, you know, with the written, we're trying to develop food codes. So we do utilize that method as well to strengthen food sovereignty, so that things like wood ash and processing white corn can be acknowledged. Things that are not necessarily seen in the larger food system can be brought to light.
Shelley, with the Meskwaki people, if people here in Iowa don't know the story of how the Meskwaki settlement came to be, it's a good time to go back and review that history. But it's an unusual story in that the Meskwaki people moved back to Iowa and bought the land and created their own community and on that land. Has that made it easier for the Meskwaki people to preserve some of that cultural heritage as compared to maybe some other communities?
Oh, it definitely has. It's because our situation and our relationship, you know, with the United States government and even like the state of Iowa, you know, it was always unique. And I believe that because of that, our little community, I mean, we're a very small community. We have maybe about 1,200 people that live out on the land. And of course, we have probably about the same amount of people that live off our Meskwaki settlement. Growing up, the one thing that I experienced was such a sense of autonomy in that community, and which evaporated, you know, once we stepped off a tribal land. It just, and then you're, you know, it's like this little island.
Yeah.
And so, like, for instance, when I went to Iowa State, like, I was so excited to get to this big university. I had such severe culture shock because I was used to enjoying that autonomy, you know, it wasn't like the Wild West, but it's just a way of being. And then going in the university, and of course, just the overall culture was very, very, very different. But I'd kind of like to speak about the annuities and commodities.
Sure.
Really quick. Because of removal and because of, you know, specifically, because, you know, natives were removed from where they had a complete food system, not just growing food, but gathering and land stewardship, land management.
And hunting.
Yeah, all of it. Because of that, you know, in these treaty understandings, we're provided annuities, some of that in the form of, you know, money, but by and large in the form of like white flour, coffee and sugar, which if you think about that, you know, that's talk about killing people. But one of the beautiful things is like right now, fry bread. I don't know if you've had fry bread, Charity.
I have, yes.
Oh, awesome. You know how good it is.
Yes.
But that is right now in food sovereignty, you know, there's kind of like the, you know, there's some people that are saying, no fry bread. You know, that's Holocaust bread. You know, that's like, but there's other people, which I always try to gravitate towards the positive, is that, no, it's a sign of resiliency because they took this white flour and they made it their own. you know, and it's unique.
And delicious.
And delicious. But that's one of the things. Annuities then, you know, those food provisions replaced our traditional foods as well as commodities. So I grew up eating USDA commodities and a lot of white rice, a lot of white macaroni product, a lot of canned goods, evaporated milk, evaporated eggs, you know, all of this stuff that's shelf-stable foods. And we know what that does to a body, but we depended on those very much to supplement our diet. So that's kind of like a couple of different eras that really transformed, you know, our native diet and with huge detrimental results.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me this hour, Shelley Buffalo, local foods coordinator of the Meskwaki Agriculture and Food Sovereignty Initiative, Grant Shadden, farm production manager at Red Earth Gardens, and Richard Elmhill, program officer for First Nation Development Institute, focusing on native agriculture and food systems. You can join the conversation as well, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the Meskwaki Agriculture and Food Sovereignty Initiative on the Meskwaki Settlement near Tama. But we're also taking a little bit broader look and talking about food sovereignty and native agriculture and food systems around the United States. With me this hour, Shelley Buffalo, local foods coordinator of the Meskwaki Agriculture and Food Sovereignty Initiative, Grant Shadden, farm production manager at Red Earth Gardens, and Richard Elmhill is also here. He's program officer for First Nation Development Institute, focusing on native agriculture and food systems. And Richard, just during the break, Shelley mentioned that the two of you met at the Great Lakes Tribal Food Summit, which brings me to the next thing I want to talk about, which is networking among tribal nations. Because, of course, while many of these nations did not have the same culture, there are shared things. And as they're trying to reconnect with that culture, with that historical culture, there's a lot of information sharing that's going on. Can you tell me a little bit about the networking that's being done on these food sovereignty initiatives?
Yeah. The Intertribal Egg Summit in Pokagon was beautiful. There was probably 60 native chefs. And one of the things that's emerging from the food movement is all these native chefs. And so we're planning the Food Sovereignty Summit in Oneida this September, and we have the iCollective, which is a group of Native chefs, sea keepers, and kind of like food knowledge holders. And so they're putting together a group of five women Native chefs. And so at events like this, it kind of brings together all people in Indian country and those that support it to share ideas, make new friends. That's where I met Shelley. We got to eat several meals together and just connect over food. And it's really encouraging because, you know, coming from communities which may be in remote locations, you really get a sense of what everybody's working on. And it kind of raises the level in a way.
Yeah. Well, and of course, the Meskwaki settlement is not in a remote location. But as you were saying, Shelley, just before the break, it's kind of like an island there in the middle of Iowa that must feel isolating in some ways. Tell me what it's like to engage in one of these summits and learn about what other people are doing around the country.
Well, we hosted the summit in 2018 and then traveling to Michigan for this year's summit, as well as I've been to two farm conferences up in Minnesota as well. And, you know, each time I go to any of these conferences, I always come back being like, I wish that I could take a whole busload of our tribal members to these events because of it's once again, it's celebrating the culture, celebrating our foods, celebrating our farming practices and our stewardship of the land. It's just a huge amount of information as well as advocacy, as well as like these beautiful hands-on workshops with like Meskwaki. Once again, you know, we've been able to, I should say, you know, we've been empowered over the years to hang on to our culture and language. But at the same time, you know, some of these workshops are like working with birch bark, working with elm to make these beautiful containers for our foods and our gathering. And, you know, these are things that, you know, we don't do anymore on the settlement, like some of these skills. And even we've had people come and hold workshops at the settlement for weaving the mats that go over our traditional houses, just things like that. And so, like, these opportunities are, you know, just powerful. It's kind of frustrating because you never have enough time. You know, you kind of have to commit to one thing at these conferences. But, yeah, I wish I could take more people, definitely.
So you're growing some of the traditional foods, but you have to also prepare them. So tell me about that tradition on the Meskwaki settlement. How has that information been shared, and how do you learn how to prepare your historic dishes?
Well, we're working on redoing our cookbook, and that needs to be done next month, actually. we better get to work on that. So what's formulating with my team is yes, having the traditional cooking methods in that cookbook, but then having some alternative, you know, busy day.
Right. It's okay to use your food processor.
Yeah. Well, I think one thing I discovered this year, thanks to working with the native chefs, is the Instant Pot and how handy that is. And so kind of doing some crock pot or Instant Pot, because that's like our convenience appliances, but right. You're still doing whole food cooking with those. Like, you're not, you know what I mean?
It doesn't compromise the food.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. So, you know, we're doing that in the cookbook, as well as we have so many wonderful cooks in our community. So at our events, I'm always trying to recruit, you know, I'm always like, hey, I heard, you know, that made this or made that. And, you know, sometimes it's somebody that's in the PTEC program down at the farm. And I'm like, so you're recruited. Our next event, you're going to come cook with us. Nice. And then we have community volunteers that can come and help out. And so it's a hands-on learning. And at many of our food events, like the one that we had yesterday, the Milkweed Festival, we had two indigenous chefs. One of Elena Terry, she's just wonderful, and she's a wonderful teacher. And she's from Ho-Chunk in Wisconsin. And our other chef, Yusuf, he's not native by bloodline, but he's our bro, you know, and he's also a wonderful teacher and stuff. So, you know, we prepared everything over the fire. And it's for us, it's just, like I said, it's always this huge learning experience. And I'm really high in learning. You know, I don't do a whole lot with my learning, but I love taking it all in.
What did you make at the Milkweed Festival? What kinds of foods were people eating?
Well, our celebrated dish was milkweed. And our community member, Mary Young Bear, and her sisters prepared the milkweed and made the fry bread. And so she wore the milkweed queen crown yesterday. And we're really happy to have her do that, because it's like her favorite dish.
Oh, nice. And how do you eat milkweed? How do you prepare it?
Well, part of the plant is poisonous. So you really do
have... I had heard that, so...
You yes. have to have good plant knowledge. My mom always reminds me that my dad's birthday, June 19th, is time to forage for milkweed. And so you collect the bud and just the small leaves on the top. And so you're just trimming that off, and then you use that. It does take a couple hours of cooking, you know, to really break those fuzzy fibers down. That's unique to the milkweed. She does add some flour, so she makes like some little tiny dumplings in there and thickens the soup that way. And then meat can be, it can be vegetarian or meat can be added. But we also had walleye that's from up north in Minnesota that we had shipped down. It was delicious. Yusuf made that. And we also had bison that is from our Meskwaki herd. And as well as wonderful vegetables that were just grown a few feet away on Red Earth Gardens. And then, of course, we had hominy and wild rice.
Grant, as a newcomer to the Meskwaki settlement, some of these foods must be new to you. Give me your impression. What? Tell me about your experience eating at the Milkweed Festival.
Yeah, so I didn't go to the Intertribal Food Summit that was this year, but right after I started, end of April 2018, we hosted the Intertribal Food Summit, and it was the best, you know, 4.5 days of eating I've had in my life. I mean, just really great flavors, unique, and then also, you know, you could eat a big meal and not feel like you immediately needed to take a nap.
And we all lost weight.
Really,
you all lost weight,
yeah,
even
I
though
mean,
you were eating the whole time?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just, it was a totally different eating experience. You know, the feeling and the flavors that these indigenous chefs can come up with is, with healthier ingredients is fantastic. So, you know, that's one of the extra perks or benefits of the job for me, not being from a native community, is getting to have that experience and seeing where the processing and the cooking and the eating, you know, it's slower, it's more contemplative, more honoring to the process, not the microwavable meal, fast food culture that's pervasive. So you come to respect and appreciate the process, and I have, as you know, a sustainable agriculture practitioner, but you know, usually when I'm growing things, once I'm cooking, it's like, okay, I cook it, eat it, you know, move on with your day. But these events help to slow people down and really appreciate and honor, you know, what sustains us.
Can you give me an example of a favorite dish that you've had the opportunity to try?
Oh, man, there's so many. I mean, the way the buffalo is prepared, you know, at the food summit, they took a buffalo from the Meskwaki herd and did the traditional harvesting of it. And throughout that summit, we got to eat everything, you know, the organ meats and the, you know, the meat itself, and it was all delicious. I'm a sucker for good wild rice when it's mixed with the veggies and things. So I can't pick a favorite. It's all been good to me.
Shelley mentioned during the break that you've spent time in Africa, and you were telling her yesterday that some of the flavors and the smells take you back there.
Yeah, so I was kind of doing what I do, running around on the farm while things were being prepped for the event, and then that smell, you know, hit me of the wood fire and the fresh ingredients being cooked over it, and you know, closing my eyes, I felt like I was back with the kids at orphanage. My wife and I were house parents at in Sierra Leone, where they did the same thing, cooking over a fire, you know, everything done by hand. And it was that same kind of feeling, and, you know, some nostalgia kicked up, and it was the same kind of eating experience, you know, that it was between meals and everything else. I mean, cooks work hard,
yeah,
in that cultural context, because it's kind of a nonstop event throughout the day. And so there, you know, you have a much more deep appreciation for cooks when it's like that. But yeah, the smells and everything were very similar. And that kind of process around not just seeing eating as something to get done and over with quickly, but to really, you know, slow down and appreciate.
Shelley, you grew up on the settlement and recently moved back there. You're also raising kids that have lived on the settlement and off the settlement. And I'm curious about your thoughts about how connecting with this food helps you think about your own personal identity. I mean, this sounds like a really powerful experience.
Yeah. So in 2011, I moved down here to the Iowa City area because I got a job down here, and I you know, I found this community very welcoming. You know, it's a pretty university town. So in general, you know, I've always lived in university towns if I haven't lived on the settlement, because in general, you know, it's a multicultural, very diverse community. But at the same time, I was just so lonely. And one of those reasons that is, you know, whenever I went home, it was just so wonderful to see faces like mine and to hear the Meskwaki language and, of course, you know, the foods. But also, I think that the main thing that brings you community is those meals, is the foods. And even, you know, when our chefs came down Tuesday night to start getting ready for this event, I made them a chicken in my Instant Pot I was so proud of. And, you know, so I fed our cooks, our visiting chefs, and, you know, we just had really good conversation. And it was like, what's that guy, Epicurus? Is that how you say it? It was so, how do you say that?
Epicurious?
Epicurious. You know, I'm reading The Consolations of Philosophy right now. So I just, but it ties into that. It's just like, he wasn't about indulgence. You know, mainly it was about eating good food with good friends. Mm-hmm. That's going to bring you happiness. And so it's not just like so much the moving around that I did is finding this food family, which extends out, you know, to like, you know, Richard, you know, where are you, Richard? Minnesota or Wisconsin?
Wisconsin.
I'm in Wisconsin now. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, we sat and we, you know, we had community. We had great conversation over in Michigan over food. And now, you know, you know, it's just amazing. It's just, you know, it's a lot of hard work. It's exhausting. But at the same time, you know, that's like, that was what I was starving for.
Oh, Shelley Buffalo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Shelley Buffalo, local foods coordinator of the Meskwaki Agriculture and Food Sovereignty Initiative. Grant, before I let you go, you just launched the Red Earth Garden Marketplace, and I know people can access that. Tell me again how people can buy your products.
Yeah, they can go on redearthgardens.com for those folks in the Marshalltown, Tama Toledo, and Iowa City areas, and place their order and pick the pickup schedule, time, and location, and we'll go from there.
All right. Grant Shadden, Farm Production Manager at Red Earth Gardens, thank you. And Richard Elmhill, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Richard Elmhill is Program Officer for First Nation Development Institute, focusing on Native agriculture and food systems. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.